Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. This is Epilogue 1, Chapter 16. Natasha and Pierre, left alone, also began to talk as only husband and wife can talk, that is, with extraordinary clearness and rapidity, understanding and expressing each other's thoughts in ways contrary to all rules of logic, without premises, deductions, or conclusions, and in quite a peculiar way. Natasha was so used to this kind of talk with her husband that for her it was the surest sign of something being wrong between them if Pierre followed a line of logical reasoning. When he began proving anything or talking argumentatively and calmly, and she, led on by his example, began to do the same, she knew that they were on the verge of a quarrel. From the moment they were alone, and Natasha came up to him with wide open, happy eyes, and quickly seizing his head, pressed it to her bosom, saying, "Now you are all mine, mine, you won't escape." From that moment this conversation began, contrary to all the laws of logic, and contrary to them because quite different subjects were talked about at one and the same time. This simultaneous discussion of many topics did not prevent a clear understanding, but on the contrary was the surest sign that they fully understood one another. Just as in a dream, when all is uncertain, unreasoning, and contradictory except the feeling that guides the dream, so in this intercourse, contrary to all laws of reason, the words themselves were not consecutive and clear, but only the feeling that prompted them. Natasha spoke to Pierre about her brother's life and doings, of how she had suffered and lacked life during his absence, and of how she was fonder than ever of Mary, and how Mary was in every way better than herself. In saying this, Natasha was sincere in acknowledging Mary's superiority, but at the same time, by saying it, she made a demand on Pierre that he should all the same prefer her to Mary and to all other women, and that now, especially after having seen many women in Petersburg, he should tell her so afresh. Pierre, answering Natasha's words, told her how intolerable it had been for him to meet ladies at dinner and balls in Petersburg. "I have quite lost the trick of talking to ladies," he said. "It was simply dull. Besides, I was very busy." Natasha looked intently at him and went on. "Mary is so splendid," she said. "How she understands children. It is as if she saw straight into their souls. Yesterday, for instance, Mitya was naughty." "How like his father he is," Pierre interjected. Natasha knew why he mentioned Mitya's likeness to Nicholas. The recollection of his dispute with his brother-in-law was unpleasant, and he wanted to know what Natasha thought of it. "Nicholas has a weakness of never agreeing with anything not generally accepted. But I understand that you value what opens up a fresh line," said she, repeating words Pierre had once uttered. "No, the chief point is that to Nicholas ideas and discussions are an amusement, almost a pastime," said Pierre. "For instance, he is collecting a library and has made it a rule not to buy a new book till he has read what he had already bought. Sismondi and Rousseau and Montesquieu," he added with a smile, "you know how much I..." He began to soften down what he had said, but Natasha interrupted him to show that this was unnecessary. "So you say ideas are an amusement to him?" "Yes, and for me nothing else is serious. All the time in Petersburg I saw everyone as in a dream. When I am taken up by a thought, all else is mere amusement." "Ah, I am so sorry. I wasn't there when you met the children," said Natasha, which was most delighted. "Lisa, I'm sure." "Yes," Pierre replied, and went on with what was in his mind. "Nicholas says we ought not to think, but I can't help it. Besides, when I was in Petersburg, I felt, I can say this to you, that the whole affair would go to pieces without me. Everyone was pulling his own way. But I succeeded in uniting them all, and then my idea is so clear and simple. You see, I don't say that we ought to oppose this and that. We may be mistaken. What I say is join hands, and who love the right, and let there be but one banner, that of active virtue. Prince Sergei is a fine fellow and clever. Natasha would have had no doubt as to the greatness of Pierre's idea, but one thing disconcerted her. Can a man so important and necessary to society be also my husband? How did this happen? She wished to express this doubt to him. Now, who could decide whether he is really cleverer than all the others? She asked herself, and passed in review all those whom Pierre was most respected. Judging by what he had said, there was no one he had respected so highly as Platon Karatayev. Do you know what I am thinking about? She asked. About Platon Karatayev. Would he have approved of you now, do you think? Pierre was not at all surprised at this question. He understood his wife's line of thought. Platon Karatayev? He repeated and pondered, evidently sincerely trying to imagine Karatayev's opinion on the subject. He would not have understood, yet perhaps he would. I love you awfully, Natasha suddenly said. Awfully, awfully. No, he would not have approved, said Pierre after reflection. What he would have approved of is our family life. He was always so anxious to find seemliness, happiness, and peace in everything, and I should have been proud to let him see us. There now, you talk of my absence, but you wouldn't believe what a special feeling I have for you after a separation. Yes, I should think, Natasha began. No, it's not that. I never leave off loving you, and one couldn't love more, but this is something special. Yes, of course. He did not finish, because their eyes meeting, said the rest. What nonsense it is, Natasha suddenly exclaimed, about honeymoons and that the greatest happiness is at first. On the contrary, now is the best of all. If only you did not go away. Do you remember how we quarrelled? And it was always my fault. Always mine. And what we quarrelled about, I don't even remember. Always about the same thing, said Pierre with a smile. Jealous. Don't say it. I can't hear it. I can't bear it, Natasha cried, and her eyes glittered coldly and vindictively. Did you see her? She added after a pause. No, if I had, I shouldn't have recognized her. They were silent for a while. Oh, do you know? While you were talking in the study, I was looking at you, Natasha began, evidently anxious to disperse the cloud that had come over them. You are as like him as two peas. Like the boy. She meant her little son. Oh, it's time to go to him. The milk's come. But I'm sorry to leave you. They were silent for a few seconds, then suddenly turning to one another, at the same time they both began to speak. Pierre began with self-satisfaction and enthusiasm, Natasha with a quiet, happy smile. Having interrupted one another, they both stopped to let the other continue. No, what did you say? Go on, go on. No, you go on. I was talking nonsense, said Natasha. Pierre finished what he had begun. It was the sequel to his complacent reflections on his success in Petersburg. At that moment it seemed to him that he was chosen to give a new direction to the whole of Russian society and to the world. I only wished to say that ideas that have great results are always simple ones. The whole of my idea is that if vicious people are united and constitute a power, then honest folk must do the same. Now that's simple enough. Yes. And what were you going to say? I? Only nonsense. But all the same. Oh, nothing, only a trifle, said Natasha, smiling still more brightly. I only wanted to tell you about Petya. Today, Nurse was coming to take him from me, and he laughed, shut his eyes and clung to me. I'm sure he thought he was hiding. Awfully sweet. There, now he's crying. Well, goodbye. And she left the room. Meanwhile, downstairs in young Nicholas Bolkonsky's bedroom, a little lamp was burning as usual. The boy was afraid of the dark, and they could not cure him of it. DeSala slept propped up on four pillows and his Roman nose emitted sounds of rhythmic snoring. Little Nicholas, who had just waked up in a cold perspiration, sat up in bed and gazed before him with wide-open eyes. He had awoken from a terrible dream. He had dreamt that he and Uncle Pierre, wearing helmets, such as were depicted in his platache, were leading a huge army. The army was made up of white, slanting lines that filled the air like the cobwebs that float about in autumn, and which de Sales called Le Fil de la Verge. In front was glory, which was similar to those threads, but rather thicker. He and Pierre were borne along lightly and joyously, nearer and nearer to their goal. Suddenly the threads that moved them began to slacken and become entangled, and it became difficult to move, and Uncle Nicholas stood before them in a stern and threatening attitude. "Have you done this?" he said, pointing to some broken sealing wax and pens. "I loved you, but I have orders from my archive and will kill the first of you who moves forward." Little Nicholas turned to look at Pierre, but Pierre was no longer there. In his place was his father, Prince Andrew, and his father had neither shape nor form, but he existed, and when little Nicholas perceived him he grew faint with love. He felt himself powerless, limp, and formless. His father caressed and pitied him, but Uncle Nicholas came nearer and nearer to them. Terror seized young Nicholas, and he awoke. "My father," he thought. Though there were two good portraits of Prince Andrew in the house, Nicholas never imagined him in human form. "My father has been with me and caressed me. He approved of me and of Uncle Pierre. Whatever he may tell me, I will do it. Musius Scaevola burnt his hand. Why should not the same sort of thing happen to me? I know they want me to learn, and I will learn. But some day I shall have finished learning, and then I will do something. I only pray God that something may happen to me such as happened to Plutarch's men, and I will act as they did. I will do better. Everyone shall know me, love me, and be delighted with me." And suddenly his bosom heaved, and with sobs he began to cry. "Are you ill?" he heard Silas's voice asking. "No," answered Nicholas, and lay back on his pillow. "He is good and kind, and I am fond of him," he thought of de Sales. "But Uncle Pierre, oh, what a wonderful man he is. And my father? Oh, father, father, yes, I will do something with which even he would be satisfied." End of Epilogue 1. All right, there we go, another chapter down. And before anything, I'm going to do an advertisement real quick. If you're thinking of doing a podcast, becoming a podcaster, please consider using Podbean as your host. Podbean.com/ander will give you 1 month free podcast hosting. Thank you kindly for your patience. Now, as we do, as is tradition here, at the end of one of the books or epilogues, I'm going to read a quick summary of the epilogue. The first four chapters was a discussion of forces operating in history: chance and genius, the ideals of glory and grandeur, Alexander's renunciation of power, and the purpose of a bee. Then we had the death of old Count Rostov, Nicholas in retirement, his mother, his meeting with Princess Mary, their wedding, estate management in the country, their family life, Sonya as a sterile flower, Denisov, and Nicholas's name day. Then we had Natasha and Pierre's family life, his return after a visit to Petersburg, the old countess in decay, conversation about social tendencies and indignation at reactionary trend of the government, and views of Pierre and Nicholas. And finally we had the two married couples and their mutual relations, Natasha's jealousy, and little Nicholas Bolkonsky's aspirations. Right at the end there, hey? Nicholas showing his aspirations. He's so like his father, and he's so like Pierre. And what a great mix, right? And he's got a bit of Maya thrown in there, and a bit of his mother, right? I can't remember her name. Wow, it's been so long. What was his mother's name? And also a bit of Nicholas. You remember when Nicholas went off to war and he was so ambitious, and you could see that it was almost like, what's the word, like, it's almost like an obsession. They get a bit carried away with their ambition. I can't think of the word now. I'm having a real mental blank kind of night. But it was a bit like that, right? Where he kind of idolizes the great people. He wants to be a great person. I really feel like that was the end of the book, wasn't it? I think that might be the end of the book. Like, there's 12 chapters to go, epilogue 2, but I've just got this feeling that those 12 chapters won't touch on our characters. It's just going to be those Tolstoy rants, political rants and historical rants, that kind of thing, because that last little bit was just such an ending, right? Like, if that's not the end of the book, then I don't know. I don't think he'll match that with endingness. Like, having the son show all these qualities of all these other characters, and it's almost like, and this is the vessel through which everyone lives on, the youth, the next generation, the next people coming up. It's almost like setting it up for a sequel. War and Peace 2. So, we've got 12 chapters to go, epilogue 2. But I just really don't think it is going to... I don't know. I just don't have the feeling that we're going to see our characters again. I think that might be it. So we have 12 chapters to go and 10 days left for the year. So what I'm going to do is, I'm not sure on which days, but some of these days, out of these 10 days, I'm going to do 2 episodes so that we end on the 31st, right? I just think that's the thing to do. And I also want to start the Hemingway list on the 1st of January, so we'll push this forward by doing 2 episodes in a couple of days. So there'll be a few days in the next few weeks when you'll get 2 episodes being released, and that'll catch us back up so that we can start on the new year. There's a whole subreddit of people, 1,600 people over at the Hemingway list, chomping at the bit to get started on this thing. So I want to start on the 1st of January for those people. I must apologize too, it's Friday, the 21st of December. Friday before Christmas means that today is work breakup day, right? After work drinks, the last day of the year. And because I'm out in the suburbs, I'm in a very tradey central place, tradesmen's, a lot of plumbers, electricians, carpenters. 9 out of 10 men out here do some kind of physical trade, labour. And so they all had their work breakup drinks tonight. And also, because it's out in the suburbs, it's drink driving territory, you know. A lot of idiots out on the road. I heard these people talking in the car today. I was Uber driving today. And driving them, which is good. You know, they're having some drinks, so they got an Uber. That's the right thing to do. But one of them was saying how these back streets. I used to drive down these back streets all the time because it's because, like, you don't get caught here drink driving. And the other one was like, yeah, man, you just don't drink drive. You just can't drink and drive. It's, like, so stupid. And the other goes, yeah, it is. It's so stupid. It's just, you just shouldn't do it. You can't do it. And I'm in the front driving thinking, oh, that's good to hear from these, like, knuckleheads in the back, that they're both saying how bad it is to drink drive and how you just can't do it. Because it's one of my most hated things is people who drink and drive. And so they were saying that, they were expressing the same thing. And I'm thinking, oh, that's good, like, these young blokes. But then they were like, because, like, you know, you lose your license if you get caught. And like, exactly, like, yeah, if you get caught, that's it. You got no license. So then I was just like, oh. All the respect that they'd garnered was just gone. Because for me, it's like, yeah, you just don't drink and drive because you're risking other people's lives, right? Which is just not cool. I think if you want to risk your own life, you know, by driving stupidly or whatever, it's one thing to risk your own life. Like, you've got the right to do that, but you don't have the right to risk other people's lives. You just don't have the right to do that. And so that's the reason that you don't drink and drive. It's because you might injure someone else. You might crash into someone. You might kill anyone. You could kill kids, old people, families. You know, if you crash your car, that's it. So, I don't know. But, you know, for these idiots out here, these bogans, it's just like, the reason you don't drink and drive is because you might lose your license. They've got just no consideration for the fact that, like, they're endangering other people. Anyway, the reason I'm on this rant is, you've probably heard all throughout this episode, in particular, like, loud cars revving in the background. It's because it's the Friday before Christmas. All the bogans are out drunk driving in their stupid loud cars. Sorry, that was a complete sidetrack. You can tell that's one of my buttons, you know. It's one of my pet peeves. So, sorry, I got a bit fired up there. Bit of a tangent. Now, regarding this chapter, it was a nice little end to the book. I'm just considering this an end to the book. Like, I'm pretty sure the next 12 chapters is just, we just got to get through it so that we can say that we did it more than anything. I've heard repeatedly this year, just like, oh, one of my favorite books, except the second epilogue, right? I've just heard over and over and over just hate for the second epilogue. And also when people have complained about, like, the particularly political chapters, or, like, the chapters where Tolstoy complains about historians, the response is, oh, just wait till the second epilogue. So I'm pretty sure we're just in for, like, 12 chapters of that coming up. But let's get through it so we can say we did it. But with that said, it's like, did we kind of, in a way, just finish the book? Because if the rest of it is just that stuff, political and history stuff, then we finished the bit of the book that I care about. Right? Anyway, Chateau Velster said, it is said that Pierre and Natasha talk like only wife and husband can, conveying thoughts quickly, in a way contrary to the rules of logic. Is this a reality in marriage, or is the conveying of thoughts to each other still a difficult thing in some instances? Well, that I can't comment on because I'm not married. I think it was just that thing about finishing each other's sentences, and I have had really, really close friends where we can speak almost in shorthand because we know, like, where each other are going with what we're saying, that kind of thing. But it seemed a little bit, like, on the nose. Like, is that really what Pierre and Natasha would have ended up like? It's kind of a weird thing. I couldn't really imagine it. The conversation is between them. I don't know. I almost had to break their characters in my head to see the conversation playing out. So they're a weird match, right? And that thing where they both spoke at the same time, and then we're like, no, you go, was really, like, to me, that's not like married couple, and that's not like the spark is still there sort of thing. That's like the signs of this relationship is going to end for me. Like, as soon as that's like, oh, the magic's over, like, you feel awkward about it, like, you're overthinking the way you're talking, right? It was a very unnatural way to speak to someone who you're so close to. So that particular bit especially was like, oh man, are they like awkward around each other? I can't see this working at all. It made me think he is not attractive to Natasha. That's what I thought when I read that bit. I don't think she finds him that attractive. Weird thought. Caucus Tree said, what's the philosophy behind all this epilogue anyway? What made the story ripe to end so early before all this stuff happened? I suppose Caucus Tree is asking, like, why did the story end back when it ended, And then all this catching up and all this extra stuff that happened in the epilogue was all just kind of like dumped. But it seems like it could just as easily have been part of the novel. My view on it is, with the epilogue, it's almost like closure, like to give closure. And so it's like you skip forward to see, like, how did they end up sort of thing. And them in their sort of final state of, like, what happened for the rest of their life. So you can sort of see a trajectory of what happened after that. And then the really thing that topped that philosophy off of, like, the closure thing is it's like, well, here's where our characters sort of ended up, quote unquote. And here's how the story continued past this day by showing young Nikolenka and him being ambitious and him showing all these qualities of the younger versions of all the people around him. It's just sort of like the author saying, and the cycle continued sort of thing. Like, you can imagine the cast growing into late adulthood, becoming like, you know, like the Rostov parents at the start of this book. That's their role now. And then you've got these young, ambitious ones, and they're coming up for their turn at what happens next. Cobby X had another explanation. Cobby X said, it's just bad writing. I don't know how else to wrap my mind around it. There's a whole lot of plot/info dumping in Epilogue 1, stuff that could have been interesting but was glossed over. Roy Lenigan said, I think it's more that it's writing from a different time. An epilogue wasn't supposed to be seen as extra or superfluous material, but rather an extension of the story. We jump ahead 7 years instead of the interim passing, as in the rest of the book. It's just as important to the story, but separate all the same. Yeah. Epilogues always divide people. Because if you just see it as, like, closure, like, we'll skip forward and just show you how everything ended up and give you a bit of closure. I like that, right? Even though it's a bit tacky, it's a bit corny, I just like to be able to know. Because otherwise I just feel, like, unsettled if I don't know how my characters ended up. So I need closure. So I loved even the epilogue on Harry Potter, which gets a lot of flack, right? That epilogue. Where we skip forward 10 years or whatever and see them with their own families and stuff. But for me, it's just like, it gives me the warm and fuzzies. It's like, so everyone was okay in the end. Or like, at least I know what happened so I can put it out of my mind. I don't like a book where I have to keep thinking and thinking. And like, if there's no way to get an answer and they just leave you with questions, it's like, it doesn't do it for me. It's not that I don't like, you know, some questions and stuff. Like, it's okay, but it's like if an author leaves me with a question and either answer to that question is underwhelming, right? So either way, it's just like, oh, okay, that's what happened. But then they don't answer it, so I just don't know. It's like, just tell me which one. Like, either way, it's not that, it's not a big deal. And to think about this ending and like figure it out for myself is not satisfying. So therefore, I don't know, it's like you've just made it worse personally. But then again, a lot of people like the open-ended ending. And yeah, so epilogues divide people. A lot of people don't like epilogues. Too Clever by 8715 said, at that moment it seemed to him that he was chosen to give a new direction to the whole of Russian society and the whole world. Oh, Special Pierre, you've changed so much, yet so little. Good point, yeah. He's back there again, thinking he's the one who's got to assassinate Napoleon because the numbers 666 appeared in his cereal bowl or whatever. And Nikolenka Bolkonsky, Dreaming of Glory, truly his father's son. I don't mind the info dump or the sudden suggestion of an affair. Putting all this in the epilogue is a reminder that life will go on for these characters without us, just as it did during the time jump that started this section of the book. In fact, I wish there was more. I'd love to follow these characters throughout the rest of their lives, through the exile of the Decemberists and their eventual return, even if it meant another 5,000 pages of Leo telling us how great he is, and how all the other historians are morons. I'd gladly take it if it meant the characters' stories would continue, but I guess I'll just have to live with it ending here. Whoa, just what do we all think of this book? It's ended now, pretty much. I suppose that's a conversation for in 12 days' time from now, but just what did we reckon, you know? Was it good? Was this a good book? I truly just don't know. It was a good experience. This was, I'm already speaking like it's over, but this was the best thing that happened this year. This was the best bit of my year. Chattel Balsa said, in Pierre's opinion, all the quarrels have to do with Natasha's jealousy about women in Petersburg. Who is this woman, and what happened to make Natasha jealous of her? Yeah, open-ended mystery ending. Who is she? I just think we won't know. But I like what Too Clever said down here about it being just a hint that life goes on and the little affairs of life and the ups and downs and the rigmarole that you have to go through, it keeps moving. You know, it's not a happily ever after. It's not like smooth sailing from here. It's just life is just dealing with problems until you're dead. That was grim. Obi-Wan Spicoli said, this kind of bugged me. Did Pierre cheat or find himself in a compromising position? Natasha goes on to ask if she was there and who is she. Any guesses? There aren't any other women or girls I can think of that we've come across. De Fleury said, oh, I'm thinking it's obviously Boris's heiress that Natasha is jealous of, Julie Karagina. Could be. Having a bit of a blast from the past. De Fleury said, sounds to me like evil ex-wife Helena came back to life with a new identity and occasionally bumps into Pierre. The whole business of Playboy Pierre indulging in pleasure with loose women was never very convincing to me, but it could be an old whore he used to know before joining the Masons and going straight. Could be that too. And lastly, De Fleury again said, oh God, we're all idiots. We forgot about the most forgettable couple in War and Peace, Berg and Vera. Vera doesn't seem to be included or helpful when pre-heiress Nicholas was worried about providing for his old mother. She's probably on bad terms with Natasha. God, Berg and Vera. Yeah. Wait, yeah, Vera is Nicholas and Natasha's sister. Is that right? She just, like, skips out. Man, yeah, De Fleury, good point. What the heck happened to Vera? That's like, it's like Tulsa just forgot a character. Was she at the funeral for her brother, Petja, and her father? Have I got that right? Is Vera, I'm going to search Vera Rostova. Yeah, Vera Rostova. Crazy. All right. Well, I'm going to put that question out there. What the heck happened to Vera? The forgotten character. And Berg and Boris, they all kind of dropped by the wayside. All right. Beautifully done, everybody. Thank you very much for listening tonight, and I will see you tomorrow.